Good morning, everyone. Everyone feeling charged up? Incredible event here. I mean, when I walked in late yesterday afternoon and just the enormity, actually, of the Boston Convention Center is sort of overwhelming. And I understand there are 12,000 people who are participating. So, you know, that is a terrific showing. So I'm Joan Parsons. I'm with Silicon Valley Bank. My role today is to help MC a very interesting topic. I'm the head of specialty banking and an executive vice president at Silicon Valley Bank. At this point, 22 years later, I feel like I'm kind of a founder because our company has gone through tremendous change in the time that I've been there, including a lot of the initiatives that we have around inclusion and diversity. And we founded, and a few of my partners from Silicon Valley Bank are in the audience, and a few of my partners from HR at SVB, we founded just not long ago a new committee of inclusion and diversity, and our company is looking at lots of ways that we could all be doing a better job, and I feel very, very proud to be part of that group. So it's relevant. This topic, of course, is very relevant. And as I sort of thought about my preparation for helping to MC this event, there are, you know, a couple of things that came to mind for me that I think has helped me navigate both in my personal life as well as in my profession. And I was sharing with my co-conspirators here earlier today. Three things, and I'll just suggest them because you might want to think about them. One is avoid martyrdom. The other is you never know unless you ask. And the third is internalize confidence. And all of that is really about relationships. And when I think about the topic that we're here to be inspired by and think about in our own lives, it's really important for us to keep thinking about that whole question of engagement is really about relationships. And those three things that I think have helped me in my life, I just thought I would share with you. So what I would like to do is introduce our speaker, our lead on the discussion. Catherine is going to come up and tell us about a lot of exciting work that she's doing, the company that she's a part of, Catalyst. I understand, actually, there was a session yesterday afternoon. I don't know if any of you participated, but they've got some remarkable things that they're doing. So tune in. Catherine's got, you know, a great background. She's been in marketing and member services and sort of, you know, strategy setting at a couple of different companies. I think most good chunk of your career was with Sam's Club and, you know, part of the Walmart. And now she is with Catalyst. A great, great topic she's going to lead off. So I'll ask Catherine to come up. And we have another person who's going to join us, Beth. And we'll get to that at the appropriate time. And then we're going to ask you all to jump into the conversation. So be prepared to do that. Thank you so much for your participation.
Yes, I would encourage you not to hold back. So, you know, speak up. There will be some opportunities for dialogue. And I did spend 30 years in corporate America. So I worked for Kraft, I worked for Tyson, and then I worked for Walmart. So I've been with Catalyst for about 2 years. And I like to say that I spent 30 years bumping my head against that glass ceiling. And then 2 years ago, I joined an organization that's helping to hammer from the other side. So a little bit about Catalyst. We are a nonprofit, a global nonprofit research and advisory organization. We're mission-based. And our mission is to accelerate women in the workplace through inclusion. The way we do that is shifting mindsets and behaviors. And we've been trying to shift mindsets for a long, long time. And mindsets take a long time to shift, if ever. But behaviors can take a matter of weeks. And so the programming that we have now is really intended to help change behaviors so that individuals can create more inclusive work environments and cultures. We have a global reputation. We do research all over the world. We are in other parts of the world. We have both a theoretical and an applied approach. So besides all the PhDs doing wonderful research, and a few of them are here in the room, we work with companies, over 800 organizations all over the world, and we look at their practices, what they're doing, what initiatives and interventions are working, and we share that with other companies. So they're tested solutions. We have access to very influential leaders. Just look at our board of directors list, and you'll see that blue chip companies and CEOs are very committed to making change. And then we have very coveted recognition programs. The Catalyst Award is the top award in the world for creating change and companies who are making a measurable difference. And we award that each year. This year it's March 8th. It's on International Women's Day in New York City. So tune in or be there if you can. So let's talk about facts. I'm going to talk pretty much about facts and experiences. So women working full-time, and you've probably heard these facts, they're very well known, earn, you know, $10,800 or 79% of what a man earns. So that's a 21% pay gap. The pay gap has narrowed, but it's also stalled. And so if we continue at the rate we are and it doesn't slow further, women will not reach pay equity until 2059. If it slows further, then it extends on out from there. The U.S. doesn't rank well, really, compared to our peers. We're 23rd out of 34 countries. So Catalyst has done some research, and what we did is we looked at, and this has been research over a decade, of women and men who graduated from MBA schools, so what we called high potentials, and we have been evaluating their experiences in the workplace. And what we saw is that women earn less than men right out of the gate, $4,600 gap. Everything like for like, same experience, background, aspirations, parental status, there was a gap. Adjusting for all those same things, that gap widened. So mid-career, $31,258. And there's two components of the pay gap. One is salary for like-to-like jobs. And we'll talk a little bit about that, but that's the one that's really shrunk over time. The bigger piece is the promotion and advancement of women over the course of their career. That is the one that is persistent, it's stagnant. That is the one where we want to accelerate progress because we're not making progress. So there's some solutions to address pay gap. External, there's public policy. So there is a lot of legislation. And many countries have reduced their pay gap through legislation by requiring pay audits, requiring companies to publicize pay transparency. The UK is very focused on that. They have about a 17% wage gap. They're trying to narrow that. Australia has legislation. So there's plenty of countries that are doing what they can because they realize the economic importance of closing that pay gap. But really, you know, what can we do in the workplace? And that's about systems and people. And I would say, once again, it's probably less about systems and more about people. There have been a lot that has been done in systems to try to narrow the pay gap. And but the people and the people who make the decisions on promotion and hiring is where the real work needs to continue. So systems approaches can include pay equity studies, pay transparency. So a lot of people will do audits. They'll get that confirmed by outside agencies. And if there is a gap, they will set aside a fund to be able to correct that. They will also help their managers in how to discuss that. So that's what we've seen a lot of companies do as they try to address this problem in like-for-like pay. Pay transparency is where employees understand where they sit, and usually that's in a pay band, and so they know where they sit within that pay band. That can arm them with information to negotiate better. So you know they say that women don't negotiate. Do you agree? I negotiate too. Catalyst research would say that women do negotiate, but they do not get the same rewards as men. Okay? But negotiation is really important. As a matter of fact, we have some research that's coming out today, again, on that longitudinal study, and we found women have been able to mitigate that pay gap by negotiating their roles. So tools today, yes, women negotiate your role, and that will help you navigate and get those opportunities. And then companies are evaluating the recruitment, promotion, and talent systems for gender bias. And I know Beth will probably talk a little bit about that. So right here is the money slide. You can see the gap, right? I mean, less than 5% of women are CEOs, 25% of senior executives, less than 10% are top earners. So that's where the real gap is. And this hasn't changed for a long time. This is where we need to make change and accelerate progress. Well, who makes the decisions on promoting and pay? It's largely men. And so for as long as we've been conducting gender research, we've been studying women and men. And in the really groundbreaking research we've done around men, we've sought to understand what are their thoughts on this and why aren't they bought in or engaged. So less than half of men think that gender stereotyping is an issue for women. 76% of women think that gender stereotyping is an issue. I'm surprised it's not 100%. So we asked men, there were actually some men that we studied that were champions for women. But we looked at the men who weren't, and we wanted to understand why they weren't engaged. And we found that there were three factors. One is apathy. It's really a women's issue. I don't see a benefit to getting engaged. There's no personal benefit for me. And I think we would all say that it's a talent issue. And there actually are benefits to men. But men just weren't aware, didn't really understand that. The second one's fear. Fear that, you know, there will be reverse discrimination. That if a woman gets a job, I might not get that job. So that zero-sum mentality is a real fear. Fear of making mistakes. Might say the wrong thing. You know, I don't know what to say. And then other men's approval. So, you know, there are some masculine norms and organizations in society, and going against those, you know, comes at a cost. And so that's an issue for men. And then there's perceived and real ignorance. So perceived, men believe that they're uninformed. They just don't know. And then real, they lack awareness of gender bias. And I'd say that's true for men. And that's, in some cases, true for women. Gender bias does exist. We all have biases. So we talked about how do we make this change then? It takes intentional leadership change and intentional behavioral change. And so Catalyst has done research on how to create inclusion where everybody has an opportunity to get ahead. And basically we found four leadership behaviors: empowerment, accountability, humility, and courage. And so our programs really revolve around that. And what's important is it's not enough just to understand you have biases. What do you do about them? And this is where the inclusive leadership behaviors helps you overcome those biases in being an intentional leader. So Mark, this is men advocating for real change. We have programming where we are engaging men, especially male executives, in an intensive workshop, a day and a half workshop, where they unpack and they learn. And these are mostly men who believe and want to make a difference, but they don't understand their own biases, stereotypes, their own masculine norms that they've had to adhere to. And so they're invited to come in and really unpack that. They understand the impact of dominant culture and white male privilege. And with that privilege, they understand that they have a responsibility to champion others and to champion women and to help engage other men in championing women. We do include some women in that, but it largely is men. And then we have an online community where men can talk about this. They can encourage each other, and they can speak about their fears, or they can ask questions. They can learn from each other. So Mark is a way that we're trying to help engage men. Because I figured that this would be a lot of women, and I'd be preaching to the choir, but I do see some courageous men in here too, so I'm hoping that you will engage and ask questions as well. But what can women do? Be an inclusive leader. If you want to be included, include others. And as a matter of fact, one of the factors that we saw where men were willing to challenge masculine norms in the workplace and champion for women was because they had female mentors. So you can actually make a difference in the lives of young men and how they navigate the organization and treat others. So be an inclusive leader. And discuss your experiences of being outside of male privilege, but do it in a non-accusatory way. Again, don't be the martyr. And then realize the pace of change is dependent on male allies. So engage them, don't alienate them. Really important to engage them in a conversation in a very open way, and know that they're nervous about talking because, again, they're afraid they might mess up. And be aware that men also face these challenges as they negotiate these masculine norms in the workplace. So with that, I'm going to invite Beth Carlson to come up from Raytheon and share a little bit of her personal and business experience with us.
That was great.
Good.
Good morning. Still morning. My name is Beth Carlson, and I am with Raytheon Company. I lead our global talent development and organizational effectiveness team. And all of the work that we do within my organization is focused on ensuring that we have a pipeline of ready leaders to drive Raytheon strategy, and that we have the organizational structures and critical workings in place as well, aligned with the strategy. So I have great work to do for a fabulous company with a wonderful team, and I'm very, very fortunate. The few things that I was thinking about, at least just kicking off our fireside chat, is some reflection that I've done based on 35 years in the business. And I've been in financial services. I've spent the lion's share of my career in healthcare. And now, as I mentioned, I'm with Raytheon. And there were three things that I spent a lot of time thinking about. The first is when I think about the strongest supporters that I have had throughout my career and the best mentors that I have had, they have been men. And the reason that I share that is because it is necessary, it is incumbent on every one of us in this room to play an intentional role in supporting the growth, the development, the advancement of women. I worked for many women throughout my career. They were wonderful and very capable and very talented. What I got from the men who I worked for, though, was a very different level of mentorship, and I'm happy to talk about that in more detail. The second thing that I think is really necessary and that has contributed to my development throughout my career is a very keen sense of who I am and what I stand for and what my values are. And so hopefully everyone in this room is equally familiar with those things that define you. And it's so necessary because it is the foundation against which everything else occurs. And it is the foundation against choice points that you likely have made or will be making. And the more familiar and aware and able you are to define those things for yourself, you don't necessarily have to share them, you just need to know what they are for you, that is, I believe, has been for me a significant contributor, again, to my growth and development and advancement. And the third piece, this is maybe the toughest. Be really clear about what it is you want. The better able you are to define and be clear about your aspirations and what you're aiming for, the better able you'll be able to get the support in achieving those aspirations. I think it was Lewis Carroll who said, if you don't know where you're going, any road can get you there. And I think that's very, very true, and I think it's very, very pertinent in terms of career, and I think it's very, very pertinent in terms of our topic today, at least on the growth and development and advancement component.
So, Beth, you mentioned something that our research shows is incredibly important and another reason why we need to engage men. Catalyst Research would say women are over-mentored and under-sponsored. A sponsor is very different than a mentor. A mentor supports you, helps guide you, develop you, but a sponsor opens doors. A sponsor will talk about you to other men, and it's the men that are the sponsors that can help make that happen. It sounds like that has happened to you over your career, so I'd be curious to hear a little bit more about the men who sponsored you, how that's helped you, and what Raytheon might be doing in terms of sponsorship.
Sure. You know, I'll speak first about some great work that's happening at Raytheon, mainly because it's contemporary, and some of my stories are ancient history. But from a sponsorship perspective, we have a practice in place where we are engaging our senior leaders, so at the very top, the direct reports to our CEO, in sponsoring three women within their respective organizations. And we're driving it down to then the next layer, you know, direct reports of those senior leaders to in turn sponsor a woman within the organization. Now, we're very deliberate about the criteria because, as you can imagine, and Catherine, you said it well, you know, our definition of sponsorship is very aligned to what you described. Sponsorship makes moves happen. So you need to be in a position where you can effectively make moves happen. Moves as in creating opportunities for visibility, creating initiatives for people to work on, creating opportunities to change roles, to your point about negotiating for roles, to actually have the political capital and the relationships within the organization to make moves happen. Now having that sort of program in place requires, it sounds so obvious. Well, you know, you just do that, you roll it out, and things happen. The reality of having that program in place is that it requires, for lack of a better word, education on what it means. What it means for a sponsor to be an effective sponsor. It's different than mentoring. It's sponsoring. And you know, catching the attention of our senior executives to be really clear about what that difference is. And at the same time, for the women that these leaders are sponsoring, what does it mean to be a protege? What is the expectation? It's not, and everyone I know is aware of this, it's not just a senior leader turning, focusing on and making it all come true. You know, it's very much about what is the role of the person being sponsored. And there are responsibilities critical things that protégés need to be doing as well. So you know, that's one of the things that we're focused on in terms of supporting the advancement of women, ultimately in terms of roles aligned with aspirations. We are bullish about that right now. We are bullish about talking to our talent about their aspirations and helping, and this is something that I have experienced and learned over the past few years, that it is harder for women to declare their aspirations than it is for men. And this is not a 100% of the time sort of thing. There are women who are very able with tremendous ease to say, this is exactly what I want to be doing. But I have been engaged in a number of discussions with a number of incredibly talented women who, you know, I know what it is that they want to be able to say, I want to be a business president. I want to be a vice president of fill in the blank. And for part of my opportunity is to help those individuals feel comfortable, that internal confidence that was referenced earlier, to claim it. To claim it. Just whatever it is, it's yours. You know, in the role that I sit in, I play no judgment because they're not my aspirations. And that goes back to my comment earlier about being clear about what it is that you aspire to doing and then claiming it. And claiming it without reservation, without hesitation. You may need support. You'll need support systems. We all do. But in the absence of claiming it, we all then can put a damper on what we're really capable of doing.
Well, again, you speak of how do you get to the top, right? And so you need to know where you're going. And the Catalyst research would say that there's hot jobs. There are jobs that get you to the top. Those are jobs that are mission critical, high visibility. They're P&L jobs. And then they're jobs that have international assignments. And claim it and claim it early. Because you've seen that gap starts off early. And if you don't start making these moves to get some of these jobs, you're going to get behind. It's going to be harder to do. So really navigating, and again, the role negotiation becomes so important. Knowing the ways that you get to the top, negotiating that role that's going to be the best fit for you, and some may want to go to the top, some may not, but what is that best fit for you that plays to your strengths and what you want to do? And then finding a sponsor who can help open the doors and get you there. And you don't just go knock on a door and find a sponsor, right? I mean, you earn it by performing and then and building relationships.
Just one other thing that you reminded me of, and this is something else that our CEO is incredibly excited about, and one of the things that we are working on is helping to create clarity around what are the experiences necessary to get to certain key roles across the organization. So what are the experiences? Just you, in the absence of that, it's guesswork unless you've got someone who's helping you, and it becomes random acts of building skill and capability versus a deliberate moves to close gaps that align with what it is that you aspire to be doing.
And so we talked about stereotypes in the workplace. Yeah, that was something from heaven. It's good.
I guess it was a good point.
And I reflect on my own experiences. And when I was very early in my career, I was in my 20s, and I was going for a promotion. And my background was in accounting and finance, and this was a marketing job, but it was for commodity products. So they wanted somebody who's analytical. And I was up against a guy, and he had marketing experience, but he wasn't as analytical. So I was doing the interview, and I really thought I was going to get that job, and I felt really good about my position and my capabilities to get the job. And then the hiring manager said, you know, I don't think women should work. He said, my wife stays at home with our kids. I said, think of me as a man. I'm not married. I don't have kids. I'll work 24/7. I ended up getting, you know, the job. Of course, then I got married and had kids because I really wasn't. And it's not that overt right now, but let me give you, it's more nuanced, but let me give you an example. So we said international assignments are really important, right? How many leaders might think, Carol might be good for that international assignment, but she's got a young family. I better not offer it to her. That's another thing about declaring your intentions and what you're willing to do, because those assumptions may be being made for you. Not ill-intentioned, really. People not ill-intentioned. I was sharing that my mother always told me, be independent, you know, go to school, go to work. My father said, well, you ought to get married by the time you're 25 or no one will want you. My father loved me. He thought he was doing the right thing. You know, again, it's these biases, these stereotypes, much more nuanced now, but they're there. And so you have to be aware of that. Everybody has to be aware of that. And we all have to work on both policies, you know, flexibility and things like that that can help us break down those barriers, but also the people in eliminating those biases and the intentional acts of behaving differently, disrupting patterns, you know, taking someone different to lunch than you typically would, picking someone for a high visibility assignment than the usual suspect. So intentional acts of leadership.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is so important, and you really touched on it's ensuring that assumptions are not being made about candidates for roles, that conversations are taking place and questions are being asked versus they're not going to go, they're not going to move, she just had a baby, you know, whatever those elements are. Well-meaning, but there's an easier way at that, which is let's not imagine, let's just ask. You know, let's just have the conversation. There's something that I've also found that goes hand in hand with that, and that is when you claim what it is you want to be doing, recognizing that over time things may change. You know, your aspirations may change. All of those things. And that is that, and this is part of the work that I'm accountable for, ensuring that the organization doesn't have different aspirations for you that may be beyond what yours are for yourself. And there's something different than seeing something in an individual and helping them to see it in themselves than having someone be really clear, this is all I want to do, I don't want to do anymore, and the system sees it. You can do so much more. We'd love for you to, you know, fill in the blank. And it's an interesting balance in terms of honoring that. At the same time, you're having conversations to ensure that what you think you know is still valid and accurate based on current circumstances and situations. So, you know, it's an ongoing discussion.
Yeah, it is. And I think there's more opportunities for women now than there used to be because there's so many more options for flexibility to ask. We had a company we worked with that was an award winner. When they asked a woman to move overseas, they found a job for her husband within the company, you know, so that they could move as a family. So there's so many more things that don't count yourself out before you check into some of these options and ask. I need an exception. I need some help. I would like to do this, but here's what I need. You talked about diverse slates. Tell us about diverse slates and how that's helping it right there.
I think like most companies, we have a really clear sense about our leadership, the makeup of our leadership across multiple levels throughout the organization. And similarly, the people who are identified across the organization as successors to those roles. So we have ongoing clarity around talent in the system and the representation of our leadership teams. And so one of the things that we started to do was ensure that for any open position at certain levels within the organization, that there was a representative slate. Period. Now, there are always exceptions, and those are necessary. But the real punchline and point to underscore is that it makes a difference, because what it requires is looking beyond the people you know. And the natural, almost the natural selection of it all. Carolyn can do it. She's done it 15 times. You know, she'll be perfect at it. Well, what does that actually do for your growth and development? If it's the same work and you do it 10 times, you've just done the same job 10 times. You haven't necessarily built additional skills and capabilities. And so really pushing for ensuring that there are diverse slates means we need to look beyond the obvious people, our go-to people, and look deeper across the organization. It doesn't change at all the requisite skills and experiences. What it means is we need to look beyond our normal sort of force field to understand talent and capabilities that otherwise we're not necessarily aware of inside the system. And it makes a difference in terms of selection.
So, Joan, I'm wondering if what does everybody think about this? And do you think we could get some comments and questions from the audience? And we've got some microphones.
In the aisles, and if you've got a question, just run on up to the mic. But since I've got the mic first, I'm going to ask the first question. So, I guess, listening to both of your experiences, and when we look at the audience here, and we're very encouraged that there are men in the audience, this conference really is for us to think about it in a more inclusive way, right? This is about women and men together in the workplace. What you just said about the diverse slate, that just, really, really clicked for me too. And when you all think of yourselves, whether, you're the hiring manager or you're thinking about your career and your opportunities, I'm very curious, without it being forced on an organization, how we can engender that idea of get beyond your force field, like in everything that you're doing, and make sure that we all sort of have a wider view. So do you have some tips about how people can do it who are not in the role of leading global talent development, et cetera, at Raytheon, but just each one of us? Do you have tips on how we can do that?
Well, I'd start by saying that get to know the person in your organization who does the work that my team does. And the only reason I say that is because part of the responsibility of the people within my organization is to know the talent. So you can look beyond your force field, but how are you going to meet people beyond your force field? We have 61,000 employees. That's really hard to do. But if you have a team of people who know talent across the organization and have clarity into the aspirations of that talent, the capabilities of that talent, the development needs of that talent, the development plans of that talent. I really wanted to ask how many people in this room have a development plan, but I'll wait my turn in the queue. So it's reaching beyond. I guess my tip would be every time as a leader you have an open role to fill, it's an opportunity to ensure you have the best talent within your company that exists, unless you need to go outside, for that role. And you should expect nothing less than to ensure that the people that you are interviewing for those open roles are diverse, period. Gender, ethnicity, background, experiences, I could go on. If you're always interviewing the same people within your same space, you're going to get your same results in terms of being able to promote the ongoing growth, development, and advancement of the talent within your organization.
What's interesting, I'm sure there's far more focus from a recruiting standpoint on the diverse slate as opposed to what goes on day to day inside a company. And, you know, I know what you're saying is we should be aspiring. And, you know, I'm very curious from the audience on that experience that each one of us has on not just assuming you sort of know what the answer is going to be. And I think there's a lot of internal recruiting and interviewing and looking for opportunities for a diverse slate, even if it's not a specific role, it's just projects, it's, you know, things that go on. How do those sponsorship opportunities actually develop, you know, in sort of a more natural state? So it's a great topic and a lot of food for thought for me and our organization, I think. Okay, you were first to the mic, so tell us who you are and what you do and what your question is.
All right, I'm Jen McCoy, and I'm with Lee Hecht Harrison, which is a talent development organization. And I actually have two simple questions, one for Catherine and one for Beth. The one for Catherine is, you know, as I look around the audience that is at the conference, I know there are many women like me who have raised young men who are now starting to have successful careers and have watched us be successful in our careers and maybe even be the primary breadwinner for the organization or for the family. So do you think that the gap with the gender biases, salary, things of that nature, will narrow at an accelerated instead of slowed down pace as these millennial men are entering the workforce and rising in their career?
Everybody would hope so. But unfortunately, there's such entrenched systems that a lot of times, even with their good intentions, they just kind of succumb to the system. But I think that there is a different willingness around these young men who've been raised like these women to defy masculine norms. And that's really important in engaging them as champions for women. So yes, I think there is an opportunity for change for these young men to learn the behaviors and practice those behaviors when they get into the workplace.
And Beth, my quick question for you, and you were sort of leading into this when you were talking about your talent acquisition and diversity, and I'm asking the question, I'm not making a statement. I think of Raytheon as a defense organization often looking to the military for hire, and that I would think would present a challenge for organizations like Raytheon and others who are in the defense industry or related to the defense industry in terms of hiring and then promoting because there are just fewer women in the military.
Yeah, so our challenge is we do hire some veterans. The lion's share of our workforce are engineers. And so our challenge is hiring STEM talent. And that pool of talent is not as large as it needs to be. And within that pool of talent, the number of women is not as large as it needs to be. So we're not on our own. You know, if we were the only game in town, then that would be still not enough, but good. But we're competing with many other organizations who are on the market for hiring STEM talent, and that is a huge challenge. And Raytheon, like many other organizations, are getting into schools and getting in front of kids in junior high, even earlier, with a variety of different programs to engage kids, women, girls, boys, to spark an interest in STEM.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll look over here. Tell us your name, what you do, and your question.
My name is Rena, and I work at State Street. So my question would be, this topic is actually really close to my home, I guess, in a way, because I'm a millennial, I'm a woman, I'm a minority, yet I'm one of those passionate people who want to make change. I maybe have this young image, but I think beyond of who I am as a person. So what advice would you give to myself who, I have to say, I have, like, amazing mentor who have mentorship from, like, executive level so I can understand the business a little bit more, yet at the same time I have this, I guess you can say, the outside noise where people would judge you because of my image, and how can I crossfire that saying, you know what, I'm maybe young, I'm a female, yet I think beyond of who I am. Like, what advice would you give so, like, everybody look more supportive and not just saying, oh, she's young, she's not ready for this?
Well, at Catalyst for a long time, we've said it's not about fixing the women, it's about fixing the organization. So be who you are, be true to yourself. It is really up to the organization and those that are in power to understand that others that aren't in power, that are in different groups, experience the organization in a very different way. I think the best thing you can do is to engage in that open dialogue so that they can get to know you and they can understand the experiences that you have that are different. And then, you know, having those courageous conversations. If something that makes you feel like, made me feel like I'm too young, or because I'm Asian, you know, you may think I'm too quiet. You may assume that I'm not assertive enough, and I'm too quiet because, you know, so being able to talk about those is really important. And what we find is that silence is hurtful. The best thing everybody can do is talk. And we have a lot of tools on how to do that because, again, it's hard. You know, so people who don't understand, they're afraid they're going to mess up. So just being open and having those conversations are some of the best things you can do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just one thing to add to that, which is I think in that open dialogue, part of it is ensuring that the issue that you think exists is actually the issue, right? So you're thinking it's because I'm young. Well, maybe it is, or maybe it isn't. So I think that's an important thing to clarify. And the second really set of questions around that is, what is it that you need from a skills, performance, whatever perspective? Because those defy age. There are certain things that you know, actually require decades of experience. Somebody could throw one out. And so if you have a year's worth of experience, you really may not be qualified for that. But you need to understand what the thinking is behind the, you know, youth, you're too young, to understand what it really is that you need to wrestle down.
So, you know, clearly Beth and I would be on the same vein with the you'll never know unless you ask. And I think that's clearly what Beth is saying, is that you do need to, you might have your own bias about how people are looking at you and viewing you and their perspective, and maybe it's off. And you need to be the one to step forward and ask the question to get the clarity.
Thank you.
Let's go over here.
Hi, I'm Eileen Martin. I'm with EMD Serono and Millipore. We're one of the sponsors. And my colleagues and I have started a Women in Leadership initiative at EMD Serono, and it's just sort of taking off now. I guess a twofold question: what advice would you have for those of us who are beginning a Women in Leadership initiative? And then secondly, I would love a little more clarification on sponsor versus mentor. I need a little more help with that.
All right, I'll start with the second question first. So sponsor versus mentor. A sponsor has the, for lack of a better word, power to make moves happen. A mentor can provide guidance and support, and it could just be, you know, people using language differently, but the way that we use the language, a mentor, you could have a mentor in a very different part of the organization who would have no real ability to actually assist in helping you move to another role. So they can help in dialogue. So that would be that's one of the ways in which we distinguish between the two.
I think there might be another thing to be mindful of with mentorship versus sponsorship. With mentorship, there's kind of nothing but upside, basically, for both parties. And with sponsorship, if some of those relationships, as I was talking about earlier, don't happen sort of spontaneously and more grassroots versus being forced upon the relationship, there is risk for the sponsor, right? The sponsor really has to be bought in and really be committed to the individual, as opposed to being asked to sponsor, because there is risk that, you know, their reputation is also at stake in going very public, you know, being more public and being more intentional in the organization about the person that they might be sponsoring for advancement and opportunities. Something to think about.
Yeah, I would agree. There is risk, but they're the ones in power that can open the doors. And so, in starting a women's network, I think that's wonderful. We have a lot of tools at Catalyst that you can take advantage of in terms of how to set those networks up. You can study some of the reports in how to navigate your career. and inclusive leader training, open it up to men. Don't have just women. Open it up to men and others. And you'll find some women, too. I mean, I know I had a mentee, and she was a Hispanic female, and I wanted her to run for president of the Women's Resource Council, and she was in the Hispanic Council because she identified more Hispanic than she did women. And so as women, we need women of all diverse women. So make sure you're inclusive. It's not just white women. Make sure it's all women, and then invite men as well.
Thank you.
Over here.
Hi. I'm Colleen Mirabello. I'm director of engineering at a small company called Surf Merchants. And my question is actually pertaining to how small we are. So we're about 35 people. There's very little turnover. And I'm the only woman on the kind of upper management level. I'm wondering if what advice you have for sponsorship when there's not a lot of roles for anybody, women or men, to move up into because they're kind of taken and solidified and the company's not planning to grow very large.
Well, I guess my, I have a couple of things. Number one, I'm not certain sponsorship is really the answer. I think that what I would advise is that for 35 people, there's a lot of clarity around who you have, what they want to be doing, and for those who may have aspirations that just simply are not going to be able to be achieved within the organization, that may create a very different conversation. And if the turnover is really low, I mean, that to me, that suggests a whole bunch of other things to me about maybe people being good where they are and being, having a different connection to the organization. So,
yeah, I think it's a choice. I was at a point in my career where I felt like I didn't have much upward movement, and I probably stayed too long. And I had greater aspirations than that, so I left. But I was behind a bit because I had just stayed on a little too long. So I think you need to make a decision in terms of where your aspirations are.
Thanks.
Over here.
My question's about having a very baby women's organization. I work for a 100-person firm, and the women at my level are the most senior women in the organization. So we have started a women's lunch. It's been about a year. It's still, the conversations we have is everybody will say, well, I'm not going to be here when I have a kid or whatever. So I'm trying to shift the conversation to include men and trying to figure out how to do that because the way we are structured now is just a women's lunch. It doesn't feel like it makes sense to invite all the men at our 50-person office. So any thoughts around kind of beginning making that baby step towards turning something from a women's lunch into, a inclusive gender situation?
I would do exactly that.
Yeah.
We've been having these women lunches. We want to open it up and be more inclusive. Everybody's invited.
Like a specific topic, maybe.
Yeah.
We've go to Catalyst again. We've got some good topics, but maybe the other thing you want to explore is why do the women want to leave? Maybe there are some policies that need to happen at the organization to get them to stay. Just because women have a baby, a lot of women, when they leave after they have a baby, it's not that they're going home.
No, they're going to other firms.
So, maybe your organization needs to reevaluate some of its flexibility policies, leave policies, and things like that.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
Over here.
Hi, I'm Lorianne Zanini. I'm a director of commercial operations at a local bank. I'm also the co-chair of our women's initiative at the bank, and we've done a lot of work around empowerment, negotiation, self-advocacy, and our goal for 2017 is to draw men into the conversation, and I'm looking for suggestions on how we jumpstart that effort.
Okay, well, I'll start. Again, this is so new. It really is new. And we're working all over the world in, engaging, and not everybody's ready for it, too. So I think reading up on some of the research so you can understand some of the reticence that men have, again, some of these tips up here on how to engage them would be helpful. But inviting them in and doing that in a very welcoming way, open way, curious curious to learn about them. It's not just about them learning about you, I think. We have some tools that can help guide those conversations and discussions.
Great, thank you.
The one piece that I would add is think about someone in your organization. There must be at least one man who gets it in terms of what you're helping the women with in terms of building their skills and capabilities. So I would turn to that person to say, this is what we're thinking about doing. What do you think? What are, you know, some things you think we're going to need to navigate? How do we make this happen? And engage that leader or leaders.
Great, thanks.
Okay, we have a couple of minutes left. Hopefully we can get to two more questions. So we're over there with you.
Hello, my name is Eric Wellers. I work at State Street. My question has to do with like these actions for women and alienation and the alienation point. What's your advice for when, like in a meeting or something, and like you, as a third party to witnessing maybe mansplaining or a man taking a woman's idea, what's your advice for how to be an advocate for what's happening without alienating the guy, especially if the offender happens to be more senior or something like that?
That is standing up for equality, and it's interrupting that behavior. It's doing it in a non-accusatory and try to, you know, a non-threatening way, but to point out and interrupt the behavior. I believe, you know, Carol had that idea. So there's a lot of tools. I talked about On the Mark community. That's a community for men. And actually, men ask other men these types of questions and try to deal and navigate that field. But I would love for you to learn more and equip more, because that's exactly what we need. So we need someone in those meetings that will stand up and disrupt those kind of patterns of behavior.
Yeah, the piece that I would add to that is this a repeat offender? And if that's the case, I would first go talk to that person to say, you know, I've been in a few meetings. I just want to share with you what I've noticed, and it's not fair. And, you know, so that when you are in that next meeting and you're disrupting, you've already addressed it. And now you're calling it out. You know, it's just different. If it's a first time offense, I'm not saying you shouldn't disrupt. It's just, it depends on the circumstances, I think, behind it.
Thank you.
Okay, one last question.
Hi, my name's Allison Plant. I'm the department chair of film scoring at Berklee College of Music. And one of your examples in the talk was of implicit gender bias might be not offering a travel opportunity to a woman because you know that she has a young family. And while I agree that's should be up to the employee to make that decision, it can actually obviously be difficult to travel if one has a young family, whether one's a mom or a dad. So I'm wondering if there are ways to broaden institutional understanding of success beyond those traditional metrics, especially when the job doesn't absolutely require. I mean, obviously, if the job requires travel, that's one thing, and you would know going in. But if I could have a Skype meeting, for instance, and get the same job done, is there a reason that I would be privileged by actually being able to travel versus being able to get the job done some other way?
Well, you know, there's so many tools and technology for virtual and things like that. It really depends on the company and the job. I mean, there's some where they, you know, just require it and they want to do everything, you know, that they can to accommodate. But certainly there's no one path to the top. You know, so we talked about, yes, there's some international assignments or travel, but there's other P&L type of jobs. So just trying to get that flexibility is what I would recommend. And I think more and more trying to figure out how to, you know, make it flexible so that you can take those types of opportunities.
Okay, so let's thank Catherine and Beth.
And may I leave one more slide? This is just one last slide to talk about, you know, what action that you can take. And so understanding more
go to catalyst.org, understand more, and then take advantage of our tools, the role negotiation tool that's new today, Catalyst X, which is free to everybody, on inclusive leadership learning. It's hosted on the edX platform, Harvard and MIT. You can find it on our website. And then for the men, to join onthemark.org. And if your company is not a supporter of Catalyst, connect them with us. We'd love to help.
And if I may just say, you know, one of the concepts I think talked about today, and Catherine and her firm are all about it, is, you know, this whole question of inclusiveness, it starts with us, right? It starts with every one of us to really embody that. And so I will leave you with that. It's our job. Start with you.